You're listening to Trek FM.
This episode of To the Journey is brought to you by Audible.com. Offering more than 150,000 titles for your tablet, smartphone, and desktop. Support the show and get a free audiobook of your choice by visiting audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
Maybe it's the journey. To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To the Journey.
To the journey!
My name is Charlene Schmidt, and with me, as he is every single week, is...
Tristan Riddell.
And we are back, as promised, with a commentary for The Killing Game Part 2. We did Part 1 last week, and for those of you who thought we were doing the whole thing in last week's episode... Sorry.
Sorely mistaken. But you're going to get it this week.
That's right. We are completionists. We wouldn't leave you hanging. And we're going to do part two this week. Now, what does the Netflix synopsis say for part two?
It is quite short and to the point. It says, Janeway and the crew must retake Voyager from the Hirogens.
Wow. That is really descriptive.
It's like I said, it's to the point because as we saw last week, they were in a holographic simulation of World War II where the Hirogens took over Voyager, and now they had neural implants in their heads making them think that they were actually in World War II, but then the doc was able to turn them off, and it is up to the Voyager crew to take back the ship.
Dun, dun, dun. All right. Well, however you watch your Star Trek, if you want to follow along with us, queue up your Netflix or however you watch it. Like I said last week, it doesn't really matter. We just want you to watch Star Trek. Or if you're listening along in the car, we will do our best to be as entertaining as possible, even if you're not watching along with us. And please do not watch and drive.
Yes, please. Whatever you do, don't do that.
Please. That is our PSA for TTJ. Okay, so we'll give you a countdown and off we will go. 3, 2, 1, play. And off we go.
I never get tired of that whenever Michelle Barrett says, previously on Star Trek Voyager, or last time on Star Trek, The Next Generation. Like, I never get tired of hearing her say that.
Yeah, I love Majel Barrett, and it's so sad that she's no longer with us, because wouldn't it just be awesome to have her voice on everything in Star Trek? And they even did get her in Star Trek 09.
Briefly, but yes, I'm glad that she was in there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, nice little homage. Yeah, I don't ever get tired of her either. She's the perfect computer voice.
Yep, absolute perfect computer voice. The most perfect computer voice. And I love that in all of the iterations of Star Trek, except for TOS, of course, they had her do the last time, the previously, the continuations, and the recaps and things like that. They had her voice it when... most of the time, they would just have one of the characters say, previously on Battlestar Galactica. You know, like this, I feel like this is the only show, or at least universe of shows, that has this had the same person do it every single time. I guess, oh, I just thought about this. Enterprise didn't do that.
I was just going to mention that. Yeah, Enterprise has T'Pol usually saying, previously on Enterprise.
Well, there was, Archer did it, I think, as well.
Did he?
I think, yeah, no, they had some different characters do it.
You're right. Okay, they mixed it up a little bit. I forgot about that.
Oh, also, that's another one of my favorites. And now, the conclusion, because it makes me think of Best of Both Worlds.
Oh, yeah, Best of Both Worlds. Quite possibly the most painful summer of all time. Now, one thing that I wanted to ask you last week that we didn't have time for is, which side would you have wanted to be on? Because we talked a little bit about Paris and the fact that it was really fitting that he was on the American side. Now, would you want to be a part of the French Resistance or one of the American boys?
Probably French Resistance, just because I love Cloak and Dagger. I love spy stuff. And I love James Bond, and so I think I'd want to be with Janeway and crew.
Gotcha. And see, I think I'd want to be among the Americans.
Oh, really? You want to be the gun-toting like I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Boop, 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 boop. I'm saving the day. Yeah.
I love that Janeway and Seven came into Astrometrics and there was a Nazi trying to figure out how to work the controls. And I was like, just try to imagine. It was a holographic Nazi trying to figure out 24th century controls.
That is an odd thought, isn't it?
I would have loved to have walked in and said, like, oh, no, I'll wait. Please, try to figure this out.
Yeah, here, just study this for a while.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So what would you think your role would be as a member of the French Resistance? What would you want to do?
Well, you know, like, I want to say something humbling, like, you know, like, I'd be the munitions expert, like, I would make sure all the people had their guns and the equipment. I'd be, like, you know, quarterstaff kind of people. But no, I'd want to be Janeway's buddy. I'd want to be Seven, like, on the ground with the 9mm, like, you know, just, like, in the black turtleneck, just sneaking through into Nazi headquarters. I'd want to be that person.
It's your fantasy. Do whatever you want, man.
How about you?
I think I'd want to be in the trenches, you know, on those front lines with Chakotay and Tommy, rifle in hand, just ready to go. Let's do this. Let's get them.
I like that about, like, I like that about 24th century, like the holodecks in 24th century, is that it's the way that it should have been in certain aspects. Like when you're talking about you want to be in the trenches with Tommy and Chakotay. Well, obviously, a woman wouldn't be in the trenches. They would be some sort of support staff or a nurse or something like that. But now, obviously, that's not always the case. And but the thing is, in the 21st century holodeck, you'd be able to do that, and those characters wouldn't give a damn.
Right.
And it kind of makes me think of in Deep Space Nine when Sisko didn't want to go back to the 1950s club or casino or whatever. Because he's like, why would I want to go back there? It's a time when my race wasn't treated very well. Mm-hmm. And then his wife says that, but it's the way that it should have been. And that's why we can explore this era. And I just thought, it's cool.
As it should have always been, right? Although, perhaps Chakotay's character might have been a little more open to having a woman on the front lines. However, yeah, I know I would have been a nurse in all reality. And well, that's just boring.
Yeah, well, I mean, for your fantasy, it can be quite exciting.
Well,
I mean,
you know, if I'm looking for a real adrenaline rush, healing wounds is not exactly what I was thinking. Now, it's a very important job, don't get me wrong, but that's not where the action is at.
Now, think about this shot right now, because we're on the bridge of Voyager, and we have Harry Kim in his operations uniform. We have a Hirogen in Nazi uniform and a Hirogen in a Worf uniform.
A
Hirogen in a Klingon uniform, all in the same shot. That's pretty amazing, and I don't think that ever happens again.
No, I think it's pretty safe to say that this is the first and only time. Now, a nice little piece of trivia about those Klingon uniforms. Apparently, they had to round up so many Klingon uniforms for this episode that they borrowed from both the Next Generation collection and from Star Trek VI.
That's right, yeah. I always find that fascinating whenever they have to grab uniforms. Like, whenever they don't make them, they have to go to the warehouse and they're like, oh yeah, this was totally used in an episode 14 of TNG or episode 37 of Deep Space Nine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I love that stuff. And I think it makes me think of when Harry Kim wore that Picard shirt in was that, episodes?
It was Prime Factors, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Prime Factors. Yeah, the pleasure guy.
Yes, in that really awful shirt.
I never get tired of seeing Chakotay in that part of his hair.
You know, it is a good look for him. I do like it. And his jet black hair. Now, it'd look even a little better if it were peppered.
That's
just
right.
Saying.
Okay, this kind of thing always makes me... there's this ultimate question that will never be answered, and there'll never be a right answer. It's always just preference, because... when I'm listening to them, like, I'm thinking about, like, oh, they're French. You know, like, my brain's just like, they should have French accents. But I was like, but... Also, when we were seeing, they wouldn't be speaking English. And like, when you look at movies that take place in a different time or a different country, but it's for an American English-speaking audience, they'll have them speak English. But a lot of times, they'll have an accent of the country of wherever they're at. So like, if it takes place in France, in like 1920 France, they wouldn't be speaking English with a French accent. They'd be speaking French, but obviously right. It's for an American audience, and so they're speaking English. But there's other movies that do it where it takes place in Russia in 1940, but they're speaking English. They're speaking English, but they don't have an accent because they're like, well, why? They wouldn't be speaking English anyway, so why give them an accent of their country? And there's so many people who are like, they're like, no, it's stupid that they have American accents. And I was like, yeah, but it makes just as much sense of them having Russian accents while speaking English. And it's just so funny how you can go back and forth, and like some people are like, it just makes them furious, but it doesn't make sense either way.
It's true. I mean, I think you either go absolutely full on authentic and you have to go way overboard with it, or as an audience, let's just play along and give them a little leeway because we get it.
Yeah.
It's just authentic enough to where we get the setting. It. We don't have to have all the details. And really, I don't know, would giving everybody a little bit of a French twang enhance the fact that they're in France right now?
Not with this story. I don't think so at all. Not with this story at all. But I love that Tom and B'Elanna, in every iteration, whenever their memory is gone, they're always together.
They are. Yeah, we saw this in Workforce, too. And
yeah.
They were just totally meant to be. That's all. One thing I do love about The Killing Game is how all the ladies are wearing that really bright red lipstick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very true to the time, and it looks good on them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, that bright red lipstick with that forehead, I mean, it just works.
Indeed.
Oh, I forgot that Janeway and Seven were the only ones that had their memory back. I completely forgot that. Yeah,
at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, at this point, yeah.
Yeah, and they're coming out of, I don't know, what would you, if you were a World War II character, you're coming out of the cupboard?
Yeah, you could say cupboard or, yeah.
Just no big deal. That happens. People come out of the cupboard all the time.
I think Janeway does a really great job, and you see this a lot in Star Trek and, you know, in TV in general, where they're thrown into a situation and they know they should know more, and so they just BS their way through it. Just like have you met Tony? I was like, yeah, I've met Tony. Like, well, what did he say? Yeah. He said he's like, you know what he said. You know?
Right. It doesn't matter which Tony you're thinking of, you know Tony.
Yeah, you know Tony. Everybody knows Tony.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay, so, like, Janeway is commanding, and no matter what reality she's in.
It's true. She just can't not boss everybody around.
I love the language in this. She's like, they're crawling with krauts. And later on, we see Paris and Janeway together when they actually have their memories back, and he's like, what's the matter, sister? The war's almost over.
Yeah. That is something Tom would say in any time period, don't you think?
That's true.
Although I did find it interesting a moment ago, I think it was to B'Elanna, Chakotay says, listen, honey. Which is something he would never say on Voyager as himself. Maybe he says it to Kathy. I'm not sure.
Maybe, but behind the scenes.
Absolutely. You know. This is like ready room material.
See, okay, it would have been funny if Janeway, you know, like she looks in a mirror and she sees her hair in this certain fashion, then she's like, hey, I'm going to keep this.
She really should have. It looks very nice.
Yeah, like I'm tired of the bun in the back.
Well, she did abandon the bun a long time ago by this point. Although maybe she just doesn't have time to curl her hair like that. You know, she's the captain.
No, I'm talking about Janeway's bun. I mean, Seven's bun, like, or I guess whatever you would call that in the back.
Oh, Seven.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, she looks really good, too. And, you know, Jeri Ryan is a very pretty lady. I think it suits her to wear her hair down a little bit, but maybe it's inefficient.
There you go.
That's probably why that didn't happen.
Not like heels at all.
Oh, right, right, yeah. Yeah, the heels. Ugh.
This has to be fun as an actor in Star Trek, where whenever you have these kind of situations where you get to put on a different uniform, because in Star Trek, you mainly, like 99% of the time, you just wear your Starfleet uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever, you know, clothes your character wears. Like, that's what they wear all the time. It's kind of like a cartoon. You know, like, they wear the same outfit all the time.
They never change their clothes.
Like, unless something special is going on. And so, it's got to be fun. You know, like, putting on that World War II uniform, or putting on that black turtleneck, or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah, even if you're not necessarily being somebody else, which they kind of are here, I imagine, as an actor, it feels sort of like, you know, how, you know, in school you have, like, a special lunch on Fridays, that sort of a thing. Like, hey, we get to romp around and play.
Yeah.
Imagine it feels like that. It's just a breath of fresh air. It's something different. Oh, here's one of my favorite things in The Killing Game. Neelix hanging out with Klingons.
Yeah, Ethan Phillips talked about how he said it was really annoying wearing Klingon makeup as well as Talaxian makeup at the same time. He said it was really uncomfortable, but he says that he didn't care because it was so much fun hanging out with these guys and being that type of character, like eating meat right off of the bone, you know, just like stuff like that. He says it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and this leads to little tidbits later on where I think this begins an infatuation with Klingons for Neelix. Because it's season 7. He has some fun with a Klingon lady later on in Prophecy.
That's funny, like,
poor Harry.
That guy just fell over, okay? The Nazi who got shot, he just fell over. He didn't like he got shot. He didn't like feel like, oh, I'm shot, and then like double over, or like he didn't like stumble or show any kind of pain. It just looked like he fell asleep.
Acting. It's acting.
Extras.
Extras acting. This is true.
This is okay. I know it's a TV budget, and I know they're holograms, and I know and everything like that, but one thing always bothered me about The Killing Game, specifically part 2, is that whenever a gun goes off, you never see you never see any ricochet, you never see any flashes. It's always just like I know that they are pretending because it's a hologram, but it's always just like kids going pew pew.
Right. Although I imagine today they would go to that level of detail because you could CGI that thing in, but back in 98 when this aired, that would have been a really big budget thing for something so small.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, today that would never happen, but, I mean, we can excuse it because it's Star Trek and, you know, we're used to phasers.
Yes, yes. I love that Chakotay calls Janeway a gung-ho kind of gal in this scene.
It's like, girls back home are a little different.
Yeah. Does that bother you? No, I kind of like it. So even when they're not quite... In full character here, they're still kind of flirting around with each other, too. Some things are just stable truths. There's constants. Eccentric people.
Yeah, like we have Janeway describing, Janeway's trying to prep a World War II era American soldier as to what to expect with encountering Klingons. She's like, they're an eccentric people. Really? Is that the term that you would use?
Well, what else would you use?
I don't know if whenever I hear eccentric, I think Einstein. You know, like, I think...
Well, they're like not that. Einsteins, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Not at least these Klingons, yeah.
I don't know, but it works. I mean, I can't really think of another word. Unusual is just as vague. Unpredictable? Maybe.
I'd love it if Chakotay would just lean over and says, like, are we still in France?
That would have been great.
Because the geography has changed quite a bit.
A little bit. Yeah, I can't say that. I don't know. I've never been to France, but I'm just guessing. This doesn't look like any part of France.
Okay, see, like, I've forgotten that Neelix actually did have Talaxian makeup on underneath the Klingon makeup, because that's so strange to me, because I thought they, like, in my memory, they just made him a Klingon, which, because they did that with Janeway, they just made her a Klingon.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, there is a little bit of inconsistency, and we pointed this out last week, too, where certain things, they could have gotten away with no makeup for B'Elanna or Tuvok, what have you, but then they go double for poor Neelix.
Yeah. Is it just because of the whole, you know, like, in the real world, humans are just the blank canvas to make aliens, and so when you put Klingon makeup on Janeway, she looks just like a Klingon, because that's what they are, but when you put Klingon makeup on Neelix, it looks like a Talaxian in Klingon makeup. I guess that could be the rationale.
Maybe.
But if they're going to go, but we've seen people who, take away entire features. Like, we've seen a Cardassian made to look like a human, or made to look like a Bajoran. And so, if they do that, because in this reality, they didn't just slap on, you know, brown makeup and latex prosthetics. They actually did surgery, like in their terms. To make it look like a Klingon. So if they do that, why didn't they just take... I know we talked about this last episode, but it just bugs me. It just bothers me.
Well, you know, the more we talk about it, the more it bugs me too, because in the 24th century, this is a thing. It's possible.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. Maybe the Hirogen just don't care that much. I mean, it's all about the hunt for them. They can totally half-ass the details.
Like, just enough to get them in the mood, but not enough for historical accuracy.
Yeah, that must be it. Neelix is in full Klingon character at this point, slapping around the doctor.
Okay, B'Elanna holding a gun, it just is not believable to me like that. Like, she looks like she's really concentrating really, really hard. Like, Tuvok looks badass. Like, he looks
does.
Like he knows what he's doing, yeah.
Yeah, he does look a little badass. But I thought the same thing about... Seven of Nine with a gun in part one. You know, where they're running through the streets and she's rescuing Neelix. I just thought,
Well, I think I found that one a little bit more believable because, like, Janeway... excuse me. I'm doing that a lot tonight. Seven, like Jerry Ryan, she put on that face like that. Like, I'm gonna kill you, you know, like that face. Like, like I feel like... But it was like, you know, the beret and everything like that didn't really help the situation. But she had the face. B'Elanna just then looked like she was pretending to hold a gun.
Well, I don't know. Maybe she's just really in character where her character wouldn't necessarily be firing a gun all the time.
That's
she's
true.
Probably not very well trained. And so she has to concentrate really hard to even get it half right.
Could be. She's just a... reconnaissance or whatever. What's it called?
Beats me.
What's the term? What's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know.
Like when you're just information gathering. It doesn't matter.
Observation?
No, it's a...
I have no idea. I'd have to actually get into the dictionary and look for words that sound like reconnaissance that mean... gathering information.
Yeah, I said it right. Reconnaissance. Yeah.
That is it?
It's
okay.
Military observation of a region to locate an enemy or ascertain strategic features.
Okay, fair enough.
Not an idiot!
No.
Yeah.
And I am waking up. We're recording this in the morning, and I've only had one cup of coffee, so I'm going to blame my ignorance on that.
Yeah, see, Janeway with a gun is always believable to me. Just be a Janeway.
Oh, yeah. When you're the leader, you've got to be badass. So, of course, you're going to know how to use a gun. Any gun.
That was another thing. It is like, Picard, they always, like, people always kind of blame Picard for being a wimp. Like, he's the diplomat. Like, he's not the action hero like Kirk is. And that's true. He's not the action hero that Kirk was. But there's so many times that Picard would get into a fist fight and win. Or he would get into a knife. Like, we saw him get into a knife fight. He threw some Klingons around. Like, he didn't do it easily, but he got it done. And I just think Picard doesn't get enough credit for his action chops. Now, we just saw Janeway get shot in the leg.
Yes.
And then trot away. And before that, I have to admit that we did see a muzzle flash and a ricochet spark.
Oh, we did. Okay, I'm glad you noticed that.
Yeah.
So there was that. They did it when it counted.
All right, so everybody's getting their memories back now.
Yeah.
because some holographic C4 exploded.
Yeah, we blew up yet another hole in the holodeck. Not quite as striking of a visual as we saw at the end of part one, but still not too bad.
I love the soap opera fade to black that Star Trek does sometimes, you know? It's like, and they're just kind of looking off into the distance like, oh, crap.
It's so much better, though, than when they did the Janeway deer in the headlights look like they did for every cut to commercial in season one.
Oh, that was a season one trope, absolutely.
Oh my gosh. Every single time it got really old. Like, whenever I watch an old season one episode now, I just roll my eyes when I see that. Poor Kate Mulgrew. She should have just stepped in and said, okay, look, this is the 12th time I've done this tonight. Could we please do something else?
Nathan Fillion was on Conan one time, and Nathan Fillion was actually in a soap opera when he first started. And
do you know which one?
I do not know which one. It's probably I want to say General Hospital, but I have no idea.
Okay.
But like he described, there's three different looks to how to give a soap opera performance, and I can't remember them right now. But please, like, just go on YouTube and look it up. Nathan Fillion soap opera Conan. And like there was one that always kind of stuck with me, which was like said something like the inevitable pleased confirmation, and he just goes yes, and just kind of nods his head. It's like we don't get that one in Star Trek too terribly much.
No, we really don't. That's fantastic.
I love that, like real life B'Elanna has no tolerance for holographic characters, like, and we just see that go on throughout the show, and she's just like, all right, whatever, like she doesn't even try to play along. She's like, you deceived me, if you say so.
Yeah. She's just really not interested in this.
Look at that ridiculous chin that Nazi has. It's like John Travolta chin.
Yeah, a little bit, now that you mention it. If he had dark hair, he could be a pretty good John Travolta. Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Yeah, there you go. It's much better than my imitation. I'll stick to Janeway impressions from here on out.
There's so much going on in this episode. Like, there's like so many different, like, we have Neelix and the doc in the Klingon simulation. We have Hiroshians on the bridge. And in sickbay, we have Janeway running around the halls with a shot up leg, and we have the rest of the crew in World War II simulation, and we have Harry who's trying to do what he can, you know, throughout the ship. I mean, there's just so many locations of business.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing considering they didn't really have much material for part two, as the writers always tend to do. Like, they have a really good part one, and then they have to fill out part two because they don't plan two full episodes. They just take an idea, run with it, and then I think they said in an interview they had a really like a good solid quarter of an episode of material for this part two, and we're really struggling to put it together. And they were like, what are we gonna do for the rest of this episode? And actually, I think this time around they managed to do a really good job. They don't always do this for two-parters. Usually part two is substantially weaker than part one, but this one I think holds up.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it definitely holds up. And we just saw probably one of my favorite scenes in the entire episode when the Doc and Neelix go off to battle with the Klingons, and he tells Neelix, he's like, run along with the man, don't argue, I'll reattach any severed limbs, just don't misplace them. And then he has the knife, and he just like, they're like, kapla, kapla, and he just kind of twirls it a little bit, he's like, tally hair.
Yeah. That's such a wonderful Doctor-esque thing to do and say.
It's a very brilliant Doctor scene.
It is. It really is. Yes, which is going to lead to my very favorite scene in the whole two-parter. But we'll get there.
I wonder what this would be like as a captain going into your own ready room with somebody else sitting in your chair behind your desk who's redecorated. You know, like, I wonder how that feels, how violated that must feel as a captain.
No kidding. It would have to be infuriating, don't you think?
Yeah.
This is my ready room. Get this crap out of it.
And I think
I don't know. That's one thing that, sorry, this always bothered me about Counterpoint, you know, when Kashyyyk takes over the ship and Janeway just so lets him do it. You know, he takes the center seat, he takes the ready room, and really just, that really irked me more than it appeared to irk her. But she's really acting very, very well in that that episode.
She's doing pretty well for having a leg gunshot wound.
Not too bad.
Like, she's just kind of like holding it just a little gingerly, like someone gave her a Charlie horse, like, Soon I'll take care of this bullet hole in my leg.
Right. Yeah, never mind the fact that it could be damaging things, but hey, it's not severed and it's not misplaced, so she's fine, and she knows it.
Maybe she just got grazed. Maybe it was just a graze.
You think? Maybe.
I think the way that she's acting and her ability to actually have a conversation, I would have to say it's just a graze.
We'll go with that because, I don't know, I've never been shot myself. But if I were,
I would imagine it hurts.
Yeah, maybe a little.
Yeah.
More like complete uncontrollable pain. I would be on the ground, you know. It hurts. It hurts. Make it stop.
I do like that the Hirogen guy, the Alpha, was talking about, like, he did give humans credit. You know, like, he was like, you know, like, he didn't just say, like, okay, let's find some good programs to battle in. He actually explored human culture and tried to learn from human culture and everything like that, and he actually started to admire it, and I like that part of it. I like that this guy is a smart guy. He's not just gonna he's not gonna go to the computer and say, like, give me the most violent thing you can give me. No, he actually does his research and try to figure out what to do. And
they actually, it's not just a hunting pursuit, like it's kind of academic, you know. He really studied it and found the worst parts of our history. And actually, you know, that's one thing I really do appreciate about The Killing Game, is especially since apparently they didn't have much of a story for part two, they managed to pull out some really great commentary and a really good backstory for the Hirogen at the same time. Too bad, guys. Now, if you could have done that every time, you know, that would have been a real feat, but hey, I'll give him credit where it's due.
Now, we just saw a Hirogen just scoff at some holographic wine, and I want to know what kind of alcohol the Hirogen's drinking.
Right. He apparently doesn't like Chardonnay or something like that.
Okay, now this scene always intrigued me, because I don't know if I like it or I hate it, but it's one of the two. And we have a holographic fake Nazi officer who convinces a real Hirogen pretending to be a Nazi to betray his alpha. Mm-hmm. Now, in this, like, this guy, like, this Hirogen, like, hates the simulation. He hates being a part of something that's not real. He even hates the friggin' wine that's not real.
Right.
And he lets a fake person convince him that he should betray his alpha. And so I don't know if that's genius or pathetic.
Right. Is it speaking to the power of the Nazi or ideal there? Or is this out of character for the character?
Yeah. I don't know.
Good question. Man, I don't know.
And I might have jumped the gun here. I don't think this is the scene where he convinces him. But it is
leading
coming
up to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of planted the seed.
See, that's okay, that shot right there, and like, I know people at home can't, you know, who are just listening to this don't understand the shot, but this is great TV shooting. Like, this is, like, right now there's so much use of depth, there's so much use of triangles, and there's so much use of eye line, and it's like when they're covering a scene, you know, like when it's Janeway and the Alpha talking on the bridge, it's, you know, like, you have Harry in the background at operations, and you're utilizing the depth of the frame so it's not just flat and two people talking to each other. And then the camera, it pans to the left and tracks a little bit back, and so it puts Janeway and the Hirogen more on the right and left of the frame, But instead of keeping it flat, as that camera move happens, a Hirogen walks in the background and stands in between them about 20 feet back. And then we just cut back to the World War II simulation, and everyone is standing around, but there's at least three planes of levels. And it's just, this is how you shoot TV. Like, not only is this such a great episode, it's visually interesting, and not just the costumes, but the way that the characters are directed and planted.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, your video production expertise come in so handy for things like this, because even if I do notice it, there's probably no chance at all that I would ever articulate that. So I'm really glad that you did.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't think Star Trek gets enough credit for this, because they, like, a lot of times, like, you know, we're in the widescreen revolution. You know, like, everything's widescreen. TV's widescreen, documentaries are widescreen, everything's widescreen. No one uses 4x3 anymore. Or at least if they do, it's very, 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 very rare. Don't even bring up Grand Budapest Hotel. I understand. But but the thing is, like, 4x3 has kind of been criticized for a long time, saying, like, oh, well, you know, with widescreen, you can have characters who are having conversation, you can be further away, and you really have better use of depth and everything like that. Well, yeah, you can do that with 4x3 as well, if you know how to do it. But there's so many current students in video production that don't have to use 4x3, like I did.
Right, and never have and never will.
Yeah, and they never have, never will. And so I was forced to learn how to do it. And I think it made it even better for me when I was using 16x9 or widescreen or anything like that. So I'm not trying to be like an old man saying, like, we're back in my day. You know, I'm just...
get off my lawn.
Yeah, get off my lawn. I'm just saying that it can be done, and it can be done well. And Star Trek usually is one of those shows that did it well.
They really did. That's major props probably to the director of photography, Marvin Rush, as well as the many directors that they had who really knew how to work the format.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the scene I'm talking about. Yeah, you got a problem with that, sister?
And she raises an eyebrow, like, really? Well, then he's.
Oh,
he
I forgot about
another great line. Loosen up, baby doll.
Loosen up, baby doll. I forgot about that one. That's what he says. He's like, yeah, loosen up, baby doll. The war is almost over.
I forgot about that part. Oh, that's fantastic. That's great.
I'm totally going to put that into my vernacular.
You really should.
Like, man or woman, I'm just going to say that to whomever. Like, loosen up, baby doll. The war is almost over.
Yeah. People are going to be taken really off guard. I love how in the captions we just saw on Netflix, loud belch among the Klingons.
And before that, when Tom was laughing, it just said chuckles in parentheses. And all I could think about was Q when he's like, and then your first officer chuckles, is it?
Right. Yeah. Anytime I see the word chuckles, I think of Chakotay.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And the Doctor does a very important thing here, turning Neelix into a Klingon leader.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Not too bad, Doc. They're Klingons, not kittens. It's a great line.
Yeah, and then he throws the meat in the fire.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to eat meat off the bone like that. Just once.
Really?
Now, here's the thing. I don't think it would be pleasurable. I don't think I would enjoy it. But, like, in like non-chicken, okay? Like, because, like, we've all had chicken wings that are, like, off the bone or anything like that. Growing up, whenever you saw a cartoon, you always saw an individual who had a bone with that half-cut piece of meat on the end, and they could, like chew it off in, like, two or one bite. And as a kid, I always wanted to do that because... Where do you get that? Like, where do you find that? Like, I've go to the grocery store all the time, and I've never seen that.
Yeah, you just don't go up to the deli counter and get them. You know, I think that's something TV made up.
I think you might be right, but where did they get it? So they just went to the prop department and they're like, "Get us some beef on a stick."
Maybe, I don't know. I always liken it to the caveman days. You know, it's primitive, it's raw.
Absolutely.
And it's kind of got that connotation. So in our civilized world, that just does not exist in our modern day supermarkets. Because we're so advanced.
Oh, this is creepy. Like, he tells her to run and...
Yeah. And then she does.
And then she does. Like, it always kind of makes me wonder, like, what if she stayed? You know, like...
But that would have been cowardly, and she's still limping, no less.
Yeah.
She still hasn't fixed that leg, and she's actually managed to run. That takes some guts.
See, okay, see, we're seeing more gunfire and explosions here, more ricochets.
Yeah, much more. Maybe they saved the budget for this part here where it's really intense and heavy.
I think, you know, maybe they didn't want to, I guess, maybe they didn't want to do it too heavily inside the ship because they're like, we don't want to screw up the set because we got to film next week. You know, like, but they can do an outdoor set, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, maybe the repairs just weren't worth it. It's a very good point. I mean, completely plausible, too. Now, apparently, it was raining like crazy out on this set here. And you can see certain parts where it is more damp. And here it looks dry.
Yeah.
And apparently, it just got really bad to the point where they decided, okay, we're going to shoot in the rain in certain parts because they just couldn't wait.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are times when you can see that the ground is quite wet, even mm-hmm. though they're dry. And I love that anything can be solved with Borg technology. Anything, like,
of course.
The grenades can be amplified, the teleporter can go farther, you know. Like,
yeah, you can nanoprobe anything. This is true.
Yeah. It's like rubbing it with cheetah blood to go faster.
Indeed. Yeah, now one thing I did not know that I read on Memory Alpha trying to prep for this thing was on one of the days where the set was really rainy, you know, we mentioned last week Jeri Ryan, she'd been really sick and sleep deprived by this point in the season. There was actually a point during the filming of this episode where she thought about quitting. Like, it was just too much.
Hmm.
And she was, she gave an interview where she said, I was sobbing, in this rain, and I just thought, do I want to keep going with this or not? Now, could you imagine? I mean, as much as I complain about it sometimes, could you imagine Seven of Nine not in Voyager for the rest of the series? Like, what if she got killed off at the end of season four?
It would have been from a story standpoint, it would have been a huge letdown. And also from a show perspective, like from an audience perspective. Actually, okay. I just want to go into this real quick. We'll go back to this. The grenade went off, and because they turned it into a special Borg grenade where it destroys holograms. Well, it destroyed Seven got shot, and then it threw back, and then it went off, and it destroyed just the stuff they needed, essentially.
Right.
Like, it just destroyed the guns and the grenades, but it didn't destroy, like, they're in a holodeck. Everything's a hologram.
Yeah, it should all be gone.
Yeah, why did it just destroy the grenades and the guns and the boxes they need, but not the street or not the cattle stuff in the background? You know, it's just
right. Yeah, it doesn't make much sense.
It even in Star Trek, it didn't make sense. But anyway, okay, so we'll go back into it. Think about it from an audience perspective. Okay, they led up to this so much. There was so much promotions about Seven, so mm-hmm. much advertisement about Seven. They rid of Kes for Seven.
Yeah.
They did all these things, like so much focus, so much effort was put into building up Seven and giving us Seven storylines. And then we get her for one season. Think about how much of a slap in the face that would be. It's like when you hire someone and you spend tons of time, like you spend 6 months to a year training this individual, sending them to classes, paying for them to get certified in certain technologies that are applicable to your business, and then they're like, oh, thanks for that, I'm gonna go to your competitor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's essentially how I would feel if Seven left at the end of season four.
Yeah, I think from an audience standpoint, it would have been such a, I don't know, a dramatic letdown. I mean, you could have written her off as a very tragic character, but then, I mean, they really did write a beautiful story for her, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, her backstory, all these things that feature her in season four, and then all of a sudden she's not there anymore. What?
Yeah,
it would have been such a shock. I mean, and then how would the show have gone on?
Would they have tried to bring Kes back? Like,
oh god, do you think?
I don't know, like, that's crazy, right?
Oh, that would have just, I don't know, that would have been such a gimmick.
It really would have.
And it'd be like, oh, well, since we can't have this lady, let's bring you back, I guess. I mean, that would have just been awful.
It was kind of the situation with TNG and Beverly, you know?
Like, well, that's true.
It's a little bit different, but about the same.
I'm sorry, got to cut you off. My favorite scene in the whole thing. Klingons and Nazis!
Klingons are fighting Nazis in France.
Yes! Where else are you going to get this, people? This is so awesome. I love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. This is something that could only happen on Star Trek.
Yeah, only in Star Trek. And the Nazi dead. Gets a bat-lith to the chest.
Yes. Oof. He's gone.
Now, I love it how Neelix and the Doc are standing back. Like, they're not entering the fray. And they, like, not only did they try to, like, make you understand, like, oh, yeah, no, they're totally not going in to fight. But, like, like he steps out to say kapla. And then he gets a little wet and then brushes his head off. Like, they don't even want to get wet. They don't even.
Yeah.
And he's a hologram.
Yeah, that should not bother him, but. yeah. Now, the Klingons are gone. All that's left is the scenery and our characters.
And the Nazis are gone.
It's over. Let's go.
So the holographic emitter was overloaded, so the hologram shut off. But yet, we still have the background, the buildings.
Right. Apparently, it didn't overload enough to completely eradicate the program altogether, I guess.
Now, here's some more continuity for you. The technology mm-hmm. that they're using to give to the Herosians to see if they want, like, the holographic technology that they can learn from or recreate or anything like that, that's the same type of cube, that yellow cube that's in there, mm-hmm. is the same type of cube that they used in TNG for Moriarty to hang out in.
Was it?
Yeah, because like in that episode where Moriarty tries to take over the ship, they trick him into going into a holodeck simulation, and so that's the data storage device that held Moriarty.
Aha. Okay, that's awesome. I've not seen that episode in a long, long time, so that's cool.
Yeah, and so it's just it's probably the same prop.
It's gotta be.
Yeah, because it looks exactly the same.
Right.
I'm just glad somebody thought to do that.
Yeah. No, that is pretty awesome. One thing I also love is that this scene here, the handing over of the holographic technology to the Herosian, is going to have consequences. Yes, there is continuity on Voyager.
Yes. And I don't know. This always did bug me. Like, I know that she needed to do this to get him off, and they couldn't fight him off. Completely.
She had to. And like, I think that scene where we just saw her sigh a little bit, she kind of regrets the decision.
Yeah.
She doesn't look like it's kind of uneasy for her, but I think she did what she had to do. A lot of people hold that against Janeway
yeah.
for doing that. Like, she is often so adamant about not letting other races have technology, but you know, I think this was a compromise where what else could she have done?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when your back's against the wall, I mean, you can either have your entire crew, you can either have your entire crew die for your principles, or you can live to fight another day. And
right.
sometimes, I mean, that's the balance, is sometimes a prime directive, you do let the crew die, or you do let other people die. But, I mean, you have to, you're the captain, and if you got to make the big decisions if you want to sit in that chair.
That's right. Risk is part of the game if you want to sit in that chair. Yes. And well, it did have consequences that we saw later on. And so it is kind of a nice reiteration of, yes, the prime directive does matter. And here's why.
Mm-hmm.
But I could imagine a season 2 Janeway sticking by her principles, and then everybody would have been dead. And then that would have been the end of the show. And
right.
So, well, you know, in a way, I'm kind of glad she did what she did. And that, folks, was the episode. That's Killing Game, Part 2. And Killing Game isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this week, and so here's a little glimpse at what else is happening on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Because it's actually legitimately trying to say something.
Yes, very Star Trek. It may be the most Star Trek of all Star Trek.
Yeah, it's definitely what I would point to as being, this is what science fiction is about.
Earl Grey.
Kovac will tell us to experience bij sometimes, in which case we will draw the bij card, Klingon word for pain. So,
is it your birthday?
It is. It's going to be a lot of fun.
To the journey!
That's the one thing we could take from Homecoming is like paragraph 1, Chakotay and Seven break up. That's for real.
Yeah, they shake hands and go, hey, it's been fun. It's been nice. Thanks for the picnic.
Yeah, see ya.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
At this point, like, they could say, yeah, why not? Star Wars crossover. I would essentially say, fine. Both franchises are dead. Let's just sew them together and see what happens.
Melodic Treks.
One of the most well thought out alien races that you only see in one episode.
Yeah, and the music is it's menacing without being over menacing, if that makes sense.
Axanar, the official podcast.
I think Justin Lin is a fascinating choice to direct because the Fast and the Furious movies, even though, yeah, they're action, adventure, road race movies, are really about a family.
The 602 Club.
That's really cool, though. I mean, I think that is a fantastic way to get to see just about any movie is kind of being able to watch it through a kid's eyes.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of our shows. We are available wherever you can get your podcasts. None of them are possible without the help of a sponsor. And so here's a little note about that.
Our sponsor for the show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to, but never thought you had the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers, Audible has something for everyone. You'll be happy to hear that both Mosaic and Pathways are available from Audible. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank you and Audible for supporting To the Journey and Trek.fm.
Also, Trek FM could not keep running without the help of you who have become monthly scribers on Patreon, because that helps us with the storage and the distribution of all these podcasts that we produce every single week. And we'd like to thank our associate producer, Lisa Stevens, who is a supporter of us on Patreon. Those of you who have subscribed and helped us out, thank you so much. Follow Lisa at Flip18 and thank her for being a supporter of Trek FM and To the Journey. If you haven't taken a look at Patreon and you would be interested in helping us out by becoming a subscriber, go to patreon.com/trekfm. All right, well, we've covered our first two-parter now. What are we doing next week?
Next week, we are doing a continuation in our series of our favorite moments from a season. And next week is our favorite moments from season two. But you'll have to tune in next week to hear it.
That's right. So until then, this has been To the Journey.
To the Journey!